guess we can start taping if it's being taped. We're going to talk about China. It's a fairly large subject tonight in a very condensed form. But it should be, I hope, interesting. It's a fascinating place and something that I've been involved with for some time. I'm Kit Nagel. I'm a professor of international management at Concordia College in New York. That's my academic side. In the commercial side, for several decades, I ran around the world for an international paper company and was marketing manager at Asia, and spent a lot of time in China, in Beijing, Qingdao, Shanghai, Guangdong, which is just north of Hong Kong, and quite a bit of time, actually too much time, according to my wife, in Taiwan. And so I've spent a lot of time in China, and it's been a fascinating time as China has come out again into the world. And the title of this session is the Resurgent China, and re-meaning again. And we in the West, we don't teach history very well. We don't teach, one of the things I teach is cross-cultural communications. Americans are not very good at that, frankly. And is a resurgent China, that China was once the dominant world economic power, all right? And then was dissipated. And so this is not a brave new world for China. China is coming into its own again. They are finding themselves again where they had been before. China is not catching up with us. They are catching up with their own history. And China, great country, 1.4 billion. It's an inconceivable number. It's 1/5 of humanity. And Chinese have a culture that goes back 3,000 years. Many Chinese can trace their own family trees back 400 generations. We can go 1, 2, 3, maybe back to Norway or something. But it's amazing spectrum. And as a part of Asia, Asia is 60% of the world's humanity. And so why is this important? It's important because Asia's fate is the world's fate. And what happens in China is hugely important. And we're going to begin and end sort of the same place. In 1978, China decided to re-engage with the world and has undertaken just dramatic market-based reforms. Which has led to the fastest growth rates ever seen in any major economy. They are absolutely on fire. China calls itself the Middle Kingdom. And this is not middle as in sort of average. This is middle is the center of things, the country in the middle. And it's pronounced Zhongguo. Guo is country, Zhong is the middle. And it always fascinated me that the name for America is Meiguo. And Mei means beautiful. So for the Chinese, America is the beautiful country. And within, you know, the frictions and whatever between our governments, there is a interest, not necessarily love, but there's interest or fascination of the Chinese with the West, and increasingly going back the other way. My own interest in China actually goes back. It's a family tradition. My grandfather was from New Zealand, and he was a Lutheran missionary in China in the 1920s. And my father was born in 1925 in Guilin, one of the most beautiful cities in China. And this was in the 20s, leading into the 30s, which was probably the most horrific period, or one of the most horrific periods in Chinese history, that is, at least up until the horrors of Mao. And that was called the Anarchy Period. It was a tough time. And so while my grandfather could read and write and preach in Mandarin, which is no small thing for the Western ear, Chinese is very difficult. There's actually an interesting Holden connection also to this era, is that, and in the past he has been up here at the village, the late Illinois Senator Paul Simon, his father was a Lutheran missionary in China, in Guilin, in the 20s. And there is this very interesting connection with the village and that part of China. So I want to talk about the resurgence of China, where China was, and then went away, in a sense, and has come back. And there is a theme of isolationism and looking inward in the Chinese worldview. And this is a little bit presumptuous of me to try and do 1,000 years of history in one session, but we're going to do the Cliff Note version, and we're going to try. Okay. Last summer, I took a group of Concordia students to Xi'an. If you have an X in Chinese, it's pronounced but it's Xi'an. And that's the ancient northern capital and the wealthy trading terminus of what we all knew as the fabled Silk Road. And this was a caravan trek of 7,000 miles, which is also inconceivable. And it went from Xi'an all the way through Samarkand, went to Damascus, all the way to Antioch, the biblical Antioch in Asia Minor. And it is civilization's oldest and longest road. It actually really wasn't a road. It was what some call a fretwork. So it was a whole series of like fibers and with the trade. But it goes back to 1500 BC, long time. 1,000 years ago, historical economists look at the world, and 1,000 years ago, the per capita income in China was higher than that of Europe. Okay, so while the Brits were sitting in their mud huts, the Chinese were already moving forward with actually remarkable technology. However, since that 1,000-year period, there has been a fall off of the standard of living and the vitality, the vibrancy of China until the height of the Mao's Cultural Revolution in 1975. It was about 7% per capita income relative to Europe. So they went where they were surpassing Europe to way the heck behind Europe. Okay. As a aside, the theme of the talks I'm going to give this week is Beyond America's Shores. And one of the classes I teach is cross-cultural communication. And one of the things that people who teach cross-cultural communication talk about is ethnocentric or ethnocentricity, where we think our culture is better than other cultures. This is not unique to America. It's common throughout the world. But ethnocentricity is where we think our way of life is better than others. We think that our way of society is better. We think that our way of business is better. We think that our way of managing is better. And that's something that one has to be always very careful about, because America, we're 5% of the world population. There's a few other folk out there. And we have to be sensitive to that. That being said, we have the ability and to have an opinion. And hopefully it's an informed opinion, but during this week I will be giving some opinions, and I give everybody a hard time. So when I am hard on the Saudis or I am hard on the communists, so be it. I'm allowed to do that. One thing between our societies in China, and the Chinese will half joke, and it's sort of gallows humor, but to survive and thrive in China, you're not allowed to have an opinion. You cannot have an opinion. One of my friends, Daniel Chow, he was 27 years in the permanent secretariat at the UN, and he regularly lectures in China. And he says, China today is Stalinist. So let us not kid ourselves. Okay, this is a command economy. This is a police state. The freedoms that we have here, we take for granted. We are natural to us. But in China, you cannot have an opinion. And there are many jokes around this, but it's really not funny. Okay. So, but nonetheless, they have an authoritarian history, and I'd kind of like to walk through that. So, getting back to this ancient civilization, which was in many ways far ahead of Europe, and again, Asia is not catching up to the West. Asia is catching up to its own past when it was this economic and technological leader. And along the great Silk Roads, the great Chinese inventions made their way west. You know, if we look at today, China's importing technology, learning how to make plasma screen and all this kind of stuff. Technology was moving from China to the rest of the world, was moving west. We all know about their invention of printing, the crossbow, gunpowder, drive belts for machines, mechanical clock, the spinning wheel, iron chain suspension, bridges. I mean, the Brits were in mud huts when they were doing this. Horse harnesses, and the maritime compass. Now, no one thinks that China, you know, was a maritime power. China was the maritime power until 500 years ago. We are the maritime power today. The Brits had their turn before us. China was a maritime power in the world. And they used a compass as far back as the 10th century, which is remarkable. So over the Silk Road and through these many centuries, these caravans have moved. And at different times, really everything in the known world went across these 7,000 miles of road. And this is fretwork. Frankincense, rhinoceros horn. They traded in dwarfs, believe it or not. Indigo, lapis lazuli. Really anything that could be traded was traded. And in the 12th century, just getting into more recent history, in the Afghan city of Hart, which was a city on the Silk Road, this is 12th century, its population exceeded that of Paris, exceeded that of Rome on the Silk Road. This is amazing from our Western perspective. Okay. No one knows what the hell happened out there in Central Asia, Far Asia. 12th century, it was larger than Rome. And this was not a major city, actually, in Asia. And anyway, it was remarkable. Last summer, we walked the six. I'm sure some of you, you know, I know Max and others have been to China. We walked the 600-year-old city walls of Xi'an, this ancient wild goose pagoda. And it's Xi'an is the place of the famous terracotta soldiers, 2,000 years old, stunningly beautiful, impossible. If you have one place to go in Asia, try and get to Xi'an, it's not possible that is there. But there are thousands, actually like 7,000 soldiers, and they each have individual features of 2,000 years ago, which is a long time. So Xi'an in China benefited from civilization's longest trade route until the middle of the 15th century, the 1400s. So at this time, China was the economic power in the world, had the highest standard of living in the world, was open and engaged with the world. And then something happened. And one of the things that happened was the Central Asia started to fracture, and there were the Turkic and Mongol Khanates. The Great Khan, Kublai Khan, Genghis Khan, started to create problems on the Silk Road in the north. And then in an astonishing, and it's full down astonishing, act of self-isolation, the Ming Dynasty decided to shut itself off from the rest of the world. So you have the most engaged country on the planet, the highest standard of living, traders par excellence, keep beating up on the Brits, but they're in their mud huts, and they turn in on themselves, and they close themselves off from the world. They had a fleet of 3,500 heavy merchant vessels. They were the global seafaring power. They took all those 3,500 vessels, they put them in the port, and they took the rigging off. They say, we're not going out again. Okay. And there's a famous date in Chinese history, 1434. And this is the date, what they call the last voyage. And that there had not been a trade voyage from China for another 500 years. And so it's mind-blowing. And there's a tradition that every Chinese student knows. There was a famous admiral, Zheng He, and he was the one that got China involved and established these trade routes to Southeast Asia, to India, to the Middle East, and East Africa. And that overnight just stopped. So what happened? Vacuum. Spain and Portugal built their empires, their global empires. Columbus got on a ship and wanted to go to the Orient. Why did he want to go to the Orient? Because the Orient was incredibly wealthy. It was the place to trade. He wasn't looking to trade beads in the Caribbean. He was looking for silks. He was looking for the great trading opportunities in China. Obviously, he ended up in another place. But really, there was a huge change with this last 1434 voyage. And it's amazing, there's a point in history where everything changed. And China disengaged from the world. Europe, by default, then was able to re-engage and establish its various empires. Good way of looking at it is the weight. Economists talk about it. The weight of the world shifted. And Europe developed, and China remained dormant. It's a very good question, why did this happen? Because this is part of the Chinese worldview, that they were once this major global power, and then they became a very relatively insignificant, poor, defenseless power. So how could a civilization do that to itself? This came at a time of where large-scale expeditions overseas were very expensive, and the time when China was preoccupied with the northern defenses against our friends, the Mongols. There's also opposition at court because there were conservative officials that found the concept of expansion and commercial ventures alien to the true Chinese ideal. So this was part philosophical. And then there was also a powerful bureaucracy that saw its power eroding the more that the country was engaged with the outside. And this was a neo-Confucian bureaucracy that led to a revival of a strict, top-down, agrarian-centered society. Very regulated, very regimented, very hierarchical, agrarian. A land of peasants and a very small elite. That was what they wanted it to get back to. And what they wanted was stability and the Ming Dynasty. Again, there were 100 million people in China at that time. They had achieved great stability. They had achieved very high levels of the economy. They looked at what they had around them. They said, we've got great art. We've got a great society. Our political system is advanced. And this promoted a belief among the Chinese that they had actually achieved the perfect society and the most satisfactory civilization that could be achieved. Therefore, extend the logic, nothing foreign was needed. And therefore, nothing foreign was welcome. So let's close the borders. Okay. What happened was in the Silk Road atrophy and went through the various, Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan and all this, the various stans of the Soviet Union. And those are tough times under Stalin. They were especially tough times under the Mongols. And they were known as the great butchers of Central Asia. And they just destroyed this whole series of towns, including Ray in Persia. The Mongols came through, they were illiterate, They didn't believe in cities, so they herded the inhabitants outside the cities, and men, women, and children killed them all, killed their cats, killed their dogs, plowed under the cities. I don't know if you've seen it. I recommend seeing it. Cinematography is great. There's a recent movie out called Mongol, and it is about the Mongols. It's a fairly benign image of the Mongols, but the imagery of Central Asia is worth seeing. So here we have China. Again, the big sweep, and we can go into a number of places, but China is then isolationist, and it's isolationist from this last voyage. And it's isolationist really until almost the 20th century. And this isolationist theme was continued by the infamous Dowager Empress. You've heard of her. And she was one in the later Qing Dynasty of the late 1800s. And she wasn't a good empress. She wasted Chinese resources on many palaces. Most famous ones for you, those of you who have been to Beijing, is the Summer Palace, stunning place. She had 128 cooks for one person. You can get the image. And she cared little for the world outside her palaces. She cared less for the people in China, the peasants, and she could give a hoot about the outside world. When the expansionist powers, again, 500 years now, we've got the European imperial powers, we've got the Brits, we've got the Germans, we got the Americans, and we've got the Japanese. And these are all now imperial powers knocking on China's door and determining that China is not pushing back. The Dowager Empress decided not to rebuff the expansionist Western and Japanese imperial powers. And the imperial powers then created what were known as concessions. You may have heard that term, these concessions. The different cities of China, everything from Hong Kong in the south to Shanghai to Qingdao. Interesting, Qingdao is where they make the beer. It's very good beer. That was a German concession. The Germans, the Chinese did not self-generate or self-develop a way to make good beer. That was good Deutsche yeast that came over with the Germans. These concessions then were really autonomous states of the imperial powers, and non-Chinese powers controlled much of China's commerce and trade, and then many Chinese decided to turn their back actually on the dynasty and the way of looking and the hierarchical society, and then said, this is kind of interesting, let's work with the foreigners. And so there's developed a merchant class, a trading class in all of the concessions, and that's a theme, and we'll come back to that. So the thing was that China had a lot of people, and the expeditionary forces of the Western powers were really quite small. And yes, the Chinese would have lost a lot of people, but they could have easily rebuffed. If they had decided to rebuff the Western powers, they could have done it. And the Dowager Empress refused to do it. And there was money allocated to the Navy to help rebuff and the Army, and she used the money for her palace. So she is not much admired in some circles in China. Anyway, there was another important date. We've got the first one, right? It was 1434. Another important date is 1898 in Chinese history. And this was when a group of reformers, which things were opening up to the West. People saw what was happening with other countries. And seeing how corrupt and archaic and broken the Chinese system was, I said, why don't we modernize? Why don't we establish our own sovereignty? Why don't we be a nation again? And why don't we move ourselves to education and engineering and technology? Why don't we reestablish ourselves? And the model that was interesting for that was the Japanese, because a little bit about Japanese history, 1868 was the Meiji Restoration, where Japan went from a feudal society and intentionally decided to modernize. Flat out, they said, tomorrow, we're going to become a modern country. We're not going to be a bunch of feudal people running around with swords. Okay? And Tom Cruise, sorry, but they decided as a country, we're not going to do this. Okay? And in a generation, they did. In a generation, the Japanese industrialized, they had a modern economy, to the extent that around the turn of the century, I think it's 1905, the Japanese fought a war with the Russians, right? And the Russians were this great imperial power, great European power, great technology, great fleet. The Tsar sent the imperial fleet around the world to punish and quell and teach the Japanese a lesson. The Japanese sunk the imperial Russian fleet in a day, sunk it. That changed everything in Europe. The balance of power in Europe just shimmied and moved. It changed everything in Asia, okay? Because what did it mean? It meant that the Asian ethnocentricity, right? The Asian powers said, you know, we can play with the big dogs. We can stand up to and become a world power. The Japanese did it. The Chinese looked over and said, Japanese did it. Why don't we do it? Why don't we establish our sovereignty again? Why don't we become a modern country again? And so there were this group of some of the best and brightest and the best educated, some Western educated, some educated in Hong Kong and Shanghai, and they put together a program called the 100-Day Program, and the Chinese still talk about this. And this was 1898. And what did the Dowager Empress do? She had them all arrested and she had them all killed. And this is one of those fulcrum points, you know, these hinge points in history where Chinese will look and they'll say, what if? What if there had been a bit more enlightened people in government, that they could have begun reform, they could have absorbed these reforms, but they were, the best and the brightest were herded together, not one or two or three, hundreds, and they were killed. And so, well, enough of that. Lesson learned, we're not going to try and reform this place because we'll get killed. Then, moving on a little bit, the last emperor was a child and a figurehead, and this was when really China was falling in on a place. It was inefficient, and there are many people who say really China's too big to govern anyway. So he was ultimately deposed in 1911, or it's called the Chinese National Revolution. And this is actually a very fascinating time when China really, in half a year, threw out the dynasty and established a republic. It wasn't exactly a democracy, but they had provisional representatives, and the provisional representatives elected, what a concept, elected the president of China, the president of the republic, and that president was Dr. Sun Yat-sen. Okay, and Dr. Sun Yat-sen, let me do a little tangent here. Dr. Sun Yat-sen is an amazing individual, and comes from a poor family. He was raised in Chinese culture. He understood Chinese culture. He also was in a mission school in Hong Kong, so he understood Chinese culture. He understood Western culture. He even studied for a time in Hawaii. And so what he brought to the table, that he could see what was good about Chinese culture and what was decrepit, and he could look at Western culture and he could say what was good and the parts that they'll kind of leave alone. And so he came back to China and became president of the Republic of China. Interestingly, he was much influenced by reading history, and there was a moment in his life when he read Lincoln and he read Gettysburg Address. And what part of that address do you think just resonated in his head? Can you think of it?
People by the people.
Absolutely. Very good. Very good. A government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Not some dynasty, not some hierarchical thing, but a government for the people. Not absolutely novel in Chinese history. And he took this and trying to infuse China with this, and he came up with what's called three principles. One was nationalism, let's get our country sovereign again. One was democracy, and the third one was socialism. All laudable good things. And both were, well, all these things were part of the constitution, actually, that they formed. Interestingly, also, he was a medical doctor, and Sun Yat-sen, as an adult, against many opposition in his own family, he was baptized a Christian. And it's fascinating that even today, Sun Yat-sen is the father of the revolution, he's the father of modern China, and the Marxist-Leninist socialists under Mao revered him, honored him, even though he had this strange religious thing, and also Chiang Kai-shek, you know, who spent his life, who was the, it's called the Kuomintang, but that was the Republic of China folk, revered. And there's famous photographs of the three of them together. They all knew each other. And unfortunately, really, China was perhaps not governable. Sun Yat-sen was this great father of modern China, but he was not able to hold it together. The Republic fell apart. Unfortunately, he died in the 20s from cancer. Actually, he died in the hospital, the Rockefeller Hospital in Peking. Kind of amazing. Anyway, what happened was then China just sort of came apart at the seams, and we entered, as I was talking before, the 20s and 30s, which was the anarchy period. It's a period of great unbelievable destitution, violence. It was the warlords, civil war, and this was the environment that the Western missions came in and tried to give some assistance, spiritual assistance, but also physical assistance with hospitals and orphanages. Okay, and who goes to an orphanage in China?
Girls
go to orphanages in China. Okay, so that was part of the process of bringing some non-Chinese traditional values in. Not killing girls when they're infants, educating girls, and this is interestingly, this was carried forward by Mao. So, as much as Mao was a disaster, China is an egalitarian society, gender-wise, and it's an interesting tradition. Then, as we all know, in 1949, Mao finally took control of China. Japanese lost the war, they were invited to leave. They also had to leave Taiwan. Taiwan was occupied by Japanese for 50 years, since 1895. And brutal, just like the other, the Chinese were not nice imperial powers, just brutal, brutalized the Taiwanese. Anyway, you all know about the rapes in China and the many tens of thousands that the Chinese killed. It was a brutal, brutal time. So when you have everything in chaos in this period in China, it became easy pickings for the Japanese to just move in. And 31, Japanese took over Manchuria. By 37, they had basically overrun all of China. And so there is, if you can think about it, there is this cultural sort of chip on people's shoulders. Look, we've been invaded by some really nasty people. We weren't able to stand up for ourselves. The Western powers came in. The Japanese came in. We couldn't stand up. We couldn't maintain our sovereignty. And it was a horrific experience. So Mao, this is really a nationalistic movement. Let's kick out the foreigners. Let's get them out, let's get our country together, and that's what Mao did. And Mao is honored to this day for, in a sense, giving back China its nationhood, giving back its sovereignty, making it a nation that was a nation. And overlooked a little bit was it was done with the iron fist. Mao was Machiavellian. But nonetheless, that's really his great contribution. After that, he was pretty much a disaster for many people in China. A couple things that are interesting is when Mao freed China from the foreigners, what did he do? Like the emperors before him, he closed the borders. He closed the borders. So the big theme here is this ebb and flow, okay? And when China is engaged with the world, it does phenomenally well. And then when it decides to close in upon itself, it stagnates. And just some thoughts, you know, when you're in China, you still meet survivors of the Cultural Revolution, and this went from 1966 to 1976. 76 was when Mao died, and this turned Chinese society upside down. It was an attempt, really, to maintain power by Mao, and it was anti-intellectual, anti-education. No one got an education for a generation. Sorry. We want people to have Mao thought, and anything is possible with group consensus. And so especially targeted were actually the children of doctors and teachers, because they, you know, they were intelligent. And there was a, you know, tragically, a sort of dumbing down of China. And if you had enough Mao thought, you could do anything. And there's a great book called Life and Death in Shanghai by a lady called Nian Chang. And since they had done away with the intelligentsia, they had done away with the educated people, their engineers and their doctors, what did you do if you had to have your appendix out? Okay, you got a peasant from the rice paddy, and you said, you are now a doctor. Okay, wholesale butchery, amazing. Just horrific. You know, if you believe in Mao enough, you can do surgery. And just turn the world upside down. So it was a time, Cultural Revolution, a time of mass terror, in which many millions died. And a little bit before that, going back to what was called the Great Leap Forward, you've heard of that, 1958 to 1961. Mao's Great Leap
68
Forward.
To what?
To 58 to 61. 58. And Mao actually had a very intimate relationship with Stalin, birds of a feather, and looked at Soviet Union and how the Soviet Union, at great sacrifice, at great cost, had industrialized. You know, Stalin sold grain overseas to buy technology so it could build steel mills. Russian people starved, but they got their steel mills. So Mao said, well, that's an interesting model. We think we want steel too. And so Mao decreed that we're going to make steel in China now, even though we don't know how to make steel. And he told, and by dictate, that the peasants were told to stop planting crops. Okay? And the peasants are now, and this is a total agrarian society, dirt poor. Everybody's a peasant, really. Except if you're elite, you know, and we're on the long march with Mao. So what happened? Mao says, okay, peasants go out and make steel. So this is like us gathering around this here and saying, okay, next week in the ballpark, we're going to make steel. Okay, so are you ready? Okay, and what do? They got iron ore, and you got these small backyard fireplaces, and they could heat up the, you need actually serious heat and technology and metallurgy to make steel. You actually do. And so what did they make? They made pig iron. Okay, so you had society not sowing its crops. You had a society making useless pig iron. Couldn't do a damn thing with it. Okay, what happened? Here we have Marxist, Leninism, socialism, Maoism. We believe in you. Okay, he's done away with the intelligentsia. He's done away with, you know, the engineers. You don't have food. Peasants didn't plant their crops, they were making pig iron. Okay, what happened? 38 million people died of starvation. 38 million people is a big number. is a big number. And this is totally at Mao's feet. The other thing, there's this great book, Mao, The Unknown Story, was out a couple years ago by Zhong Cheng. They did a very thoroughly researched, and they calculated, including those 38 million, 70 million Chinese died because of Mao's decisions. They perished under Mao's rule. And this is really when China was not at war. This was just self-inflicted. You have Mao. You have what the Chinese today, my friends, they say, well, he was the equivalent of a modern emperor. Okay, he had 100 concubines, just like the emperors did. If you go to Tiananmen Square, okay, you can see his mausoleum. Okay, and Chinese friends say, well, that's just, you know, a modern day emperor's tomb. They don't say it with a lot of love in their heart. It got so bad that everybody was hungry all the time. And there's a greeting in China that's even carried forward to today. The standard greeting, not hey, how you doing, is have you eaten? Okay. Ni shi le ma is have you eaten, you know? And if anybody has a bit to eat, then you give it to them. So, by the way, back on Tiananmen Square, it's the political heart, just an aside here, where Max has been there, a bunch of folk have been there, where a million people, it's designed so a million, China doesn't mess around, a million people can assemble. You know, we think it's a big deal to get 80,000 people in an arena. This is a million people. And it's huge, it's the political center of China. You remember in 1989, that's where they rolled the tanks over the students. And as a college professor, I get pretty protective of students, and that really pisses me off, because that you're killing the best and brightest. And China did it, right, in 1898, and they did it again in 1989. And no one really knows how many were killed, but China tends to eat its young at times. Interesting, just coincidence historically, June 4th, 1989 was when they rolled the tanks. June 4th, 1989 was the day, there was the date of the first free election in Poland. So just a little historic coincidence that's kind of fun. Just a little anecdote, a friend of mine in Beijing's father was a professor of physics at Peking University. It's not Beijing University, it's Peking University in Beijing. He was a physics professor, world-class mind, was educated in London and I think in MIT. World-class physics mind, and then was teaching at Peking University. During the Cultural Revolution, he was denounced. And you know, some neighbor got pork and was denounced. And he was denounced because he was contaminated by Western society, by the corrupt, you know, we're all running dog capitalists in the West, therefore, you know, under that skin, this world class physicist was denounced. And it hurts me because this is a personal friend who wept when he told me this, is that his father, and this is a world-class mind, he was, the rest of his life, he was a night watchman at a warehouse. This is pathetic. This is evil. And this is what happened in the Cultural Revolution, how China hurts itself. And so you see these swings of history where China tries to get open, is open, closes, open, closes. And where as soon as Mao died, new era, right? We get to 1978, and since 1978, China has become the world's most successful economy. It grows an average per year, about 8%. Income has increased about ninefold since 78, and it's a very interesting place to be. A couple points here is that through this sweep of history, and in some of the other sessions this week, we'll come back to China because China is so important. But the Chinese know their history. They know who their 100th and 200th grandparents were. They know their history. They know they were a great power. They know they just hurt themselves. And so for them to now be a strong international power, ultimately will be the dominant economic power in the world again. Again, they're not catching up to us. They're catching up to their own tradition, their own culture. This is not a surprise for them. This is a normal progression for them. And it's really the rest of the world that says, well, where are these people coming from? Couple final comments on what China is doing today. Since about 1980, 300 million people have moved from the farms to the cities. That's like moving America, okay? And in the next 20 years, they're going to move another 300 million to the cities. Part of this is possible because they have moved away from this Marxist-Leninist stuff where you had the communes, and they always have nice-sounding things, and they have a thing called household responsibility system. And the household responsibility system is that farmers can produce crops, and they can sell the surplus and keep the money for themselves. Amazing concept. It was a concept that people knew in 1898. It's a concept that Sun Yat-sen. And what happened? As soon as that happened, China was just food yields bloomed. Just boom. And China is in no risk anymore of famine. There's not going to be, you know, millions and tens of millions of people dying of famine. They can't quite feed themselves. They import a lot of our soy and that. But they can feed themselves. What does this do? There's a follow-on, knock-on effect of this. You don't need that. You can get efficient agrarian production. You don't need everybody down on the farm. Okay. So they intentionally are now moving to the cities, and the government has said, we want to be a modern city, a modern culture, a modern economy. We want to reestablish our place in the world. And make no mistake, the veneer of market-driven economies and all that kind of stuff is nice, but the funding for nearly every Chinese company comes from the Bank of China, and the Bank of China is the government and the golden rule, right? Who has the gold makes the rules. So this is China incorporated. So their big piece is we need to modernize, we need to bring in technology from the West. We used to export technology, now they need to bring in technology. And here we are with these cities, and firstly they demonstrated that they could do it. And what they did, they went to what were once the concessions. And they called them special economic zones because there was a tradition of trading, there was a tradition of sort of entrepreneurial risk-taking. There was a tradition of people that understood finance. If you scratch somebody in Shanghai, you're going to get they're communist, but you're going to get a capitalist. They really get it. And the folks in Beijing, they like to think they run the country, but Shanghai and these concession areas really do. And I'd like to close, and maybe if there's some comments, but there's... In Shanghai, which is the most modern city in the world, some of you have been to Shanghai, it is, through the years that I've been there, it is now almost unrecognizable from where it was 15 years ago. In the early 80s, there was a single hotel in Shanghai. It was 17 stories. Now they build things 43 to 60 stories. It's dwarfed. It's the most modern city in the world. It is stunning. And the Shanghaiese are relishing this ability to engage with the world. And they have an expression. I love this expression. And it goes back to the times of the emperor, where you have the political powers way up there north in Beijing. They can make their nice policy. but we're going to be down here, we're going to be trading and engage with the world. And the expression is, the sky is very high and the emperor is far away. So this is a fascinating place, and there's a final quote that I've kept with me. It's from our friend Napoleon Bonaparte, and he talks about China, and he says, when the dragon awakens, the whole earth will tremble. And the dragon has awakened. Yes, yes, Jerry. By the way, you don't get the first question, Jerry. No, go ahead, Jerry.
Recently, on public broadcasting, there was a series on China. And on the agrarian move into the city, they really referred to them as guest workers, that they would come in, live in dormitories at very low wage, through their vibrant working years, and then they were not expected to stay and to move out. I don't know if that's accurate or not. They also had university students in which they showed the famous smuggled out photograph, Tiananmen Square, with the fellow standing in front of the tank, and they showed it to them, and they asked these students if they knew what that was. And they gave some mystical answer, which had absolutely no relationship to what happened in 1989. Were these presentations on public broadcasting?
Generally, well, I won't do my three-part harmony on why the media gets so much wrong, but generally, yes, and there's the Chinese society does not try and be fair. And what is expedient works. And the people in the cities, in the special economic zones that are citizens of those zones, they have social security, they have access, and they have legal rights. The itinerant workers that come in that are abused because they don't have legal standing, they don't. If we have time, there are hundreds of protests each year in China that are not reported, obviously, in the West, and are not reported in China. And there is a simmering resentment against the autocracy and the lack of freedom and the lack of legal recourse. There is no separation of the courts from the government. And the outcome, and this is not hyperbole, the outcome of your case depends upon your guangxi, which means the relationships, some would say a bit more than relationships, the connections, the pull that you have with the legal system. So China is trying to keep a handle on discord, while at the same time it's in a hard spot because it has to find jobs for this 1.4 billion people in these cities. That's a hugely good question. A little aside on that, a chap I worked with in Shanghai, it's not so much the case now, but it used to be under the Maoist and the Communist era that your labor management was done through what was called your work unit. And that was called your Danwei. And you had no choice what you were going to do in life. You had no choice what job you were going to do. Okay, here was a university graduate, multilingual, spoke English, idiomatic English, could have done a great service to the country as a liaison with the outside world. And Dan Wei assigned him to work at freeze his butt off at a chicken farm next to the Soviet border. This is again pathetic, and this is why, that would make me mad, and it made him mad. And so the more educated the country gets, the less tolerant it's going to be of this sort of top-down. But there's no mandate to be fair in China. That's kind of cruel, but that's there.
Are you going to talk later about the influence of the return of Hong Kong in this?
I can another night. I'd love to talk about Hong Kong, which is fascinating. Just a quick, it's to do the whole session, that's a great topic. In China, in the early 80s, you could not travel without permission internally. Now that has been relaxed. However, you still need an internal visa to travel to Hong Kong if you're Chinese. So there are limits to your freedoms. But I
In particular, I'm interested in this notion that some people have that Hong Kong is operating as a little laboratory, to see. And the question will be, will the rest of China become more like Hong Kong, or will Hong Kong be swallowed up in the post-Maoist China?
So the Chinese are, in my view, are being fairly smart about Hong Kong, because here they were, a peasant, broken, people living on a buck or two a day. And across the border in Hong Kong, you have this incredible entrepot center, incredible financial center, people living really well. And they say, well, that's the defunct running dog capitalist living really well. Okay? And they, and then taking back Hong Kong, they didn't want to, and they could have inherited an empty shell.
Right.
Because, sounds arrogant, but at that time the Chinese really didn't understand international finance, that with electrons you can move capital anywhere around the world. They could have inherited a shell. And so they've been very careful to not alienate the population too much. They have some sort of by-elections in the city and that. It's a hugely, hugely good question. Yeah.
Could you comment on the role of the place of Christianity?
I know that I've seen numbers that there is a strong rebirth of Christianity in China. I'm not sure I believe it, but of the number, around 8% of Chinese now have some affiliation with some form of Christian church. There are many churches in Asia, specifically. The Koreans are hugely active in China, and sort of as a below-radar, sub-rosa look at it. It's a balancing act, and I'm not happy. I'm gonna get myself in trouble. I'm not happy with some of the deals that some of I'll be quiet that have been made.
There's a official Chinese Christian church.
Yes, there is.
And those pastors are trained by the state. So you've got that aspect of Christianity. And they have modern buildings, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have the storefront.
And given the Protestant backgrounds and the Roman Catholic Church backgrounds, I think the Roman Catholic Church is actually doing a better job of not being subservient to the central government. I don't want to get myself in too much trouble. But it's a very, very good question.
Is it true that the current premier president of China has a PhD in business administration from Harvard? I heard that.
He does have an advanced degree in economics. I don't know if it's from Harvard. I don't know.
What's his name?
It's Hay.
I've heard, and I like to watch a lot of PBS, although I don't have formal education in this, but it's always been my understanding that in this change, I mean, what they have is an industrialist dream. They have unlimited cheap labor, and they have the ability to control their money supply, and basically, to me, this is my opinion, they're using business theory as a tactical weapon and created a national scale monopoly to be able to compete against the world. And they're doing a very good job of it. They can control the currency. They have they're basically stealing all of the manufacturing of the world and moving it to China. Well, in this country, it's against the law to have a trust or a monopoly or do that type of tactic. And you said, beware the rising dragon. We should be very concerned about that type tactics as it relates to our own economy, and we're just starting to see the influences of now.
I think it's a good point, and it is authoritarian. It is China Inc. There's also one of the companies I really don't like, U.S. companies, is Walmart. That's basically a joint venture with the Chinese government. So whenever you see, you know, they put the bunting up, you know, red, white, and blue, and they tell how well they treat their employees. It's they have 6,000 vendors. Nearly all of them are Chinese. And I could do a session just on Walmart itself. It's China's prerogative to run its economy the way it wants to run its economy, and we have to be smart. I have great optimism, and this is maybe a segue to a session tomorrow about the U.S. role in the world as it is evolving, and it has to accommodate and manage that relationship with China and India and the others. But it is a China is also in a hard spot because they have, you know, you've got 300 million people moving to cities and they don't have jobs, and you've got another 300 million in the next 20 years. They are addicted to manufacturing. They have to find jobs for all of this population. Population explosion went back to Mao. Mao said, we don't have any resources. What do we got? We got people. So he made women, or gave incentives to women to be heroes of the revolution. So, you know, a dozen children, okay? So China went from a couple hundred million to a billion four. And so this is another legacy of Mao.
What about the one-child policy?
The one-child policy was in recognition of the stupidity of Mao.
Is that still enforced, one-child?
It's still enforced.
Okay, so it's been 30 years since 1978, and they're on pretty good projectors. What's going to be like 30 years from now, and, you know, what are the keys to their, you know, future?
That's a very smart people trying to figure that one out. They in 30 years, again, you can look at it from pure sort of dollar exchange rates, or you can look at it from the economic point of view, your purchasing parity. Is that, you know, in 20 years, 25 years, they may come close to the size of our economy. I think they're at least a generation away. People I respect say they're at least two generations away from being a dominant global power the way the United States is a global power in the 20th century. They have huge problems, and they are addicted to manufacturing for social reasons, that it's a social veneer. People are really not happy. And so long as they're improving a little bit each year, they'll tolerate the system. But it's going to be really bad, I think, if there's an economic downturn. And we are in kind of a unique relationship, sort of codependency now, with China. They're addicted to manufacturing and getting their people to work, and we're addicted to low prices, you know? And we're addicted to their recycling, you know, recycling dollars in debt and to pay for our debt, to pay for our Iraq war, to pay for, you know, our own stupidity here. You know, we're fairly slow. The thing is, what happens? If we stop buying from China, they will this is my judgment. You know, I'm wrong a third of the time. But if we stop buying from China, they will explode politically. They will just flat out explode. We would take a huge economic hit. You know, no one in this room would have shoes, right? And inflation would be very, very strong. It would bring down their, so they, you know, who's over what balance? So it's this sort of codependency that is being managed.
Can you say a little bit about Japan and South Korea as industrial powers in that region, and how are they trying to pull off them into their system, or is it still competitive?
Yeah, we need to cut.
Okay, we need to cut. Okay, I'm sorry, we'll come back around. Thank you.
Thank you.